first of all, I'd like to say I think it was a very, very good lecture. And for once, in a long, long while, I feel I can really agree maybe 99% with the SPGB. But there were some questions and some points of query. The question that Steve started off with, i.e., is Marxism a science of dogma? I think possibly it would be important to clarify this point, because it's a very important one. To me, Marxism is scientific, it's not a science. Science is a particular framework of theory or reference, if you like, which is peculiar to capitalism. In fact, it is a very, very integral theoretical part of capitalism. Marxism is a revolutionary theory, and therefore, while it might be scientific, while its whole premise, its basis is scientific, it can't be institutionalized as a science. Maybe it's a pedantic point, but I think it's a very, very important point. And the second question or query I'd like to actually raise was on when Steve made a critique of Lenin's material and imperial criticism, which I agree, it's a very, very bad piece of work. I think Lenin wrote it in something like 6 weeks. He essentially just looked up references. And it's a very crude, deterministic piece of work. But I doubt very much whether Lenin wanted to actually oppose Dechkin in this. I think he wanted to oppose other members of the Russian social democracy, i.e., for instance, Bogdanov, who was attempting to actually bring in to Marxism and into the Russian party the concepts of Ernst Mach and very, very idealistic concepts, which was taken up by Bogdanov and other people, for instance, Maxim Gorky, were also attempting to take up this idealistic conception of materialism. And I'd like maybe the speaker to comment on those two queries.
Yeah. On the first point, I wouldn't go along with it entirely. I think that the distinction between a science and a scientific attitude is not as great as you state. Although I would agree with you, in fact, if you're making the point that Marxism is not applying scientific methods which belong simply to the rest of natural science. It is applying a particular what could be called proletarian logic, or a particular form of science which is applicable only to the condition of the working class in capitalist society. On that I wouldn't have any disagreement. That's on that point. On the second point, did Lenin want to oppose Dechkin? Well, first of all, you're quite right. Lenin wrote Materialism and Empirical Criticism in one of the most difficult periods in his whole life of political opportunism, because he was up against an organised group amongst his own party, people who published a journal called Forward. They were known as the Forward Group, mainly, I think, it was led by Bogdanov and Lunacharsky, and they were putting forward a theory which Lenin certainly said was similar to that put forward by Ernst Mach. It doesn't matter whether it was or not, and I don't think entirely was. Their argument was that the working class should have a secular religion.
Exactly.
They actually had a slogan, which I can't even remember what it was now, something like bringing God to the people, or people's God, or something like that. That's a God building, yes. And the argument was that all previous religions and all previous gods have belonged to the ruling class, and it's about time the working class had one. I mean, there's no doubt about it, and it has been pointed out by people in the past that one can understand Lenin's impatience in writing Materialism and Empirical Criticism, because the group he was up against within his own party had some extremely crude and anti-working class ideas. I don't claim that Lenin only wrote that in order to oppose Dechkin. I wouldn't say that for a moment, because it's absolutely untrue. What I would say, and what I did say, was that I think that was one of the purposes of doing it. Lenin, in fact, refers in that to certain, I'm not quoting accurately, but I'm paraphrasing, certain positivist schools of philosophy. Now, he wasn't there referring to Bogdanov and Lunacharsky, because they would not be described as a certain positivist school of philosophy. And I think he may have been referring to Dechkin. I think, furthermore, that the fact that the work was not published in English, it wasn't translated until 1927,
is again... reference to Dechkin, isn't it?
No, he doesn't.
Oh.
No, because again, But what he does do, and this is interesting, and it's not been referred to, there's never been any, I mean, this is to some extent, it's an area that's not been discussed much by historians. In 1927, there was an article in a journal called the Labour Monthly, which was a journal which at the time, by the late 20s, was very much, it was just at the time of the publication of Lenin's Materialism, and it was very much an anti-Dietzkin position, because places like the National Labour Colleges and so on were largely dominated at that point by people who had supported the Stalinist position, and they were opposed to a great extent by that stage to the works of Dietzkin. There's a great deal of evidence to show that. In 1927, out of the blue, there was a translation of this article, the only article which Lenin wrote on Dietzkin until, as far as I know, the recent years, an article that hadn't been referred to at all by historians, where Lenin, in fact, generally praises Dietzkin, but during the course of it, I think there is a phrase which is something to the effect of, in many ways, Dietzkin misinterprets the philosophical ideas of Marx and Engels. You know, you could, if you can find it, you can refer to the article itself, or I've got a copy, I can show you it. Now, I think, in fact, that it wasn't that Lenin primarily wrote Materialism and Empirico-Criticism in order to attack Dietzkin. What I do think was that it was translated to English and it was distributed very widely in 1927 in order to oppose Dietzkin. And the main point I want to make, and I think 1927 is a watershed insofar as it is significant, because there was a distinction between what used to be called the old-style proletarian logic, as Stuart MacIntyre writes in his book, that in the old days when lecturers used to go into the Welsh valleys and they used to say, I'm now going to give a lecture on philosophy, and everyone would stand up and say, oh, you're talking about Dietzkin. Everyone would say that he was known, it was very well read. The thing about it is that after 1927 there was a change away from that because of the whole, as you know, the whole way in which the Communist Party perverted and destroyed Marxist understanding during the 1930s, the whole way in which all of the ideas which had belonged particularly to the pre-war British working class movement were seen to be in some ways alien to the new Stalinist approach to Marxism. And I think that's why it was published in 1927, although I readily concede that I'm only speculating, because you're quite right, Lenin doesn't refer to Dietzkin in that, although I think there is an implicit reference when he talks about certain schools of positivist philosophy, and I don't think that more can be said. Incidentally, come the day when that wretched old organisation, the Communist Party of Great Britain, falls to pieces, and we can all get at their record books in their minutes, we'll be able to find out things which will be of great interest in relation to this. But at the moment, we can't. And the trouble is that most of the old Communist Party members of that period tended to die Stalinists, and therefore you can't even get hold of them and find out what was going on the Central Committee and to what extent there were official policies.
On page 138 of Joseph Dietzkin's philosophical portrait, philosophical essays, we find the following. Oh, by the way, I'd like to thank you for excellent lecture. We find this statement, and this is a quotation. It was necessary to struggle through the wrong path in order to attain to the knowledge of the right one. Now, would the lecturer please give me an opinion on that statement? And as it's a formal question, could we have an answer in formal, limited logic, yes or no?
The answer to your second question is no. The answer to your first question is I've absolutely no idea what context this remark is taken in. Now, in order to struggle to the correct conclusion, you have to experiment with wrong ones, is that it?
Well, it was necessary. He's actually speaking about historical events, of course, and says it was necessary, and also in the case of philosophy, it was necessary to struggle through the wrong path in order to attain to the knowledge of the right one.
Well, I don't agree.
Well, if I may say, I think this has a very, very pertinent application to the working class today, which persists in taking wrong paths. Now, Dietzkin's view was that it was necessary in order to find the right one.
Oh, well, I would disagree with that in one sense. I mean, I don't think it's necessary to take the wrong path in order to arrive at the right one. Obviously, I can think of occasions where that is not the case. In finding my way into a public house, it's not necessary that I take the wrong road in order to get the right one, or in discovering what the meaning of a book is, or a question is for that matter. It's not necessary that I have a misinterpretation in order to arrive at a correct interpretation. And on the other hand, I suppose there's a certain sort of casual validity about it in one sense. I suppose you could say that people do tend to make mistakes before they do the right thing. And you are right, of course. It goes without saying that during the process of experience, a working class does have to make mistakes and in order to go through a period of experience which leads to correct answers. But that is certainly not... it's the last advice we would want to give workers, that they should go through mistakes. That is something the working class manages to do spontaneously, as it were.
Just something I'd like to clarify.
Sorry,
the distinction between the interpenetration of opposites.
Yeah. Certainly the interpenetration of opposites argues that there are factors within any given entity which are similar to factors which are in the opposite to that. So that, for example, take capitalism as a good example. There are factors within capitalism which are the prerequisites of capitalism. There are factors within capitalism which are prerequisites of socialism, which are prerequisites of its opposite, of its antithesis. The unity of opposites would argue that, in fact, within, by looking at any particular entity, any particular being, the combination of factors within that particular being are no different from the combination of factors that would be found in its opposite. It's not much more or less than that. I mean, in his book called Historical and Dialectical Materialism, Stalin argues that, in other words, the contradictions which exist within any particular entity are no different from the contradictions which could exist, making it something which is its opposite. It's a unity, therefore, between two things which appear to be opposite. The opposites are only appearance. And, for example, one case of that which has been cited is the example of love and hate. And Freudians would like this argument, because the argument is that the process by which you love someone is not only contains within it similarities to the process by which you hate them, but that, in fact, love and hate are only two parts of one long chain. They're the same thing in that sense. I think one must always be careful when you're talking about philosophy not to elevate a theory which is a piece of trickery into a theory which is not a piece of trickery. And in a sense, I mean, my understanding of it is that if you in fact talk to someone who holds this Stalinist view and you say to them, well, for example, there was a work written called On the Two Stages of Socialism, which was written some years ago in Russia. And the person who wrote it argued that, in fact, the stage of socialist society, the lower form of communism, as they refer to it, was no different from capitalism in appearance. But this was because there was a unity of opposites, that although you were dealing with opposite things, there was only an appearance of opposition. It was, in fact, an identity. And, frankly, when you come across arguments like that, like with certain other arguments, you can't dispute them very simply by means of logic. You can only dispute them by means of saying this is obviously not the case. One only has to look at the thing and see that it's not the case. The trouble is, as soon as you start playing around with formal logic, as soon as you start arguing against the first law of formal logic, which is that A cannot be anything other than A, you're opening the floodgates for those people who are going to try not simply to argue on a higher level of logic, but to in fact argue illogically. And I would say the unity of opposites is such a case.
I'm sorry. I find it difficult to reconcile the two, Marxism as science and Marxism as dogma. I've often had people talk of scientific socialism, things like that. Was the phrase a coined one? Does it fall under dogma? Not dogma or science. What was it in scientific socialism? I read it in a editors, had spoken by politicians, you know that. And it brought me to confusion. I mean, this Marxism and science, the other one I don't know. Was the world scientific situation dogmatic in the sense of
Very interesting. I can ask it very simply. Scientific socialism is simply the argument that you are not proposing socialism as an ideal, but you are proposing socialism as a material proposition, as something which is an effect of a particular cause, the cause being the problems of capitalism. That socialism and capitalism are connected as part of a logically definable process. In that sense, we can argue that we're scientific socialists, because we can argue that we employ a scientific methodology which enables us, which is comparable with other sciences, in the sense that it enables us to reach conclusions which are fairly verifiable, which we can actually show to be valid on the basis of scientific criteria. Now, dogmatic Marxism, I say, makes the mistake, and I think you can refer to people who pay lip service to Marx, but in a dogmatic fashion, in this way. What very often happens is that people develop a theory in order to enable them to explain things which are very complicated, and which, if you do not theorise about them, you will not be able to fully understand. For example, anyone who wants to become a medical doctor can't possibly approach the subject of illness simply by having a broad view of all of it. So what happens is you have to break it down. You break it down into a theory of diagnosis, a theory of pharmacy, a theory of gynecology, a theory of psychiatry, and so on. I'll forget the last one. Now, when it comes to that, what they very often forget to do is to recognise that once they've developed the theories, beyond the theory there is a reality which that theory is supposed to be describing. And they mistake the theory for the reality, so that you get people who are sort of stuck in a theoretical time warp. They're stuck in a fossilised position where they've actually described something, but they have forgotten to reapply that description to the constantly changing factors within what they are describing. So we as scientific socialists would be dogmatic socialists if our understanding of socialism ignored all of the changes that are going on within capitalism, ignored all of the factors within the day-to-day class struggle, and simply tried to fit reality into the theory. That's what very often happens. A very good example of it is language. We invent language in order to invent concepts which we cannot define in any other way. If I could communicate with you, and you could communicate with me through a subtle system of body language, we wouldn't have the verbal use of language, but we invent words. What we tend to do with those words is that we allow the words to dominate us. So that because of the poverty of language, because we don't have sufficient words to express everything we want to say, we look at something and we say, there's no word for this. So what we do, we adapt reality to language. We actually have to find a sufficient way within the limited linguistic forms we have in order to describe the reality in front of us. And we try to cut reality to suit the weapons we've got, the instruments we've got, which can describe it. Exactly the same with society. Those people who, for example, say Russia must be socialist because this factor, that factor, that factor, and that factor is so in Russia. And we can find it in this chapter of Marx, that chapter, that verse, that footnote. Marx said this, Marx said that. And of course, if you do that for long enough, you can not only argue that Marx said that Russia was socialist, you could argue that Marx was cohabiting with Jesus Christ, and you could do who knows what. So when it comes to it, anyone who develops a theory forgets why the theory was developed and then expects reality to act in accordance with the theory becomes dogmatic. And there are far too many people who call themselves Marxists who unfortunately do that.
Yes, I think that they cover it.
did do to full justice to Frank Casey when he said that he was dull at St. John's. He wasn't a subtle dialectician. I think he was too closely reading McIntyre's book and hadn't paid too strict attention to Casey's own works. Because I've talked to some of the two people, some of the old stages in Lancashire, who knew Casey as a lecturer, and they said that he was a most invigorating lecturer. And I think that the reason why Casey's gone out so shall we say, was because his ability, his critical ability, of course, was too much for the right wing of the Labour Party to cope with. And then because he was a far more able dialectician than what the Communist Party was producing at that time, of course, he came under attack from them as well. So Casey, in a sense, fell between two stools, fell between the right wing of the Labour Party. When I say the right wing, I don't just mean the politicians, but the intellectuals, because the people who took over running the pedlies in the 1920s, the Cedar Falls, etc., and the Oroville's, they've been taught in the bourgeois universities of this country. And of course, by this time, empiricism was the going philosophy, sort of thing.
They were members of the Communist Party.
Eh?
They were members of the Communist Party.
Well, perhaps they were or not. But I'm saying that they were intellectuals who were trained in bourgeois universities in this country, and as such, they weren't taught to be dialecticians. And they opposed Casey, not just because of his... or they opposed Casey principally because of his dialectical things. And of course, and that was a real tragedy in many ways for the Labour movement as such. And I think that one of the things which the Labour movement has to do is, in a sense, to resurrect Casey and republish his books. Because when we do that, we begin to see that the man, far from being justified, on the contrary, the man should be praised for his sheer ability, and it's the fact that he was up against the right wing in the Labour Party and against the non-directors in the Communist Party that led to him being castigated. And McIntyre, in a sense, takes that over from the sources, the various people that he spoke to. And I think that our lecturers paid too much attention to them and not sufficient to guess his own words.
Okay, let me say one or two things about this. Glad you raised the point. First of all, I have read Casey's works, so I'm not unaware of them by any means, and to some extent I can't deny I've been influenced by them. I still would argue, and I'll go on to that in a second, that I think that they were, in comparison with Deakin's works, fairly crude and to some extent a misapplication. Whether he was a good lecturer when he was in Lancashire, I don't know, but I mean, if he was, that's very pleasing to hear. I think you're absolutely right, you know, you raise a valid point. First of all, you're right, some of my information about Casey comes from McIntyre, simply because, as far as I know, he's the only person in the last 10 or 20 years who's actually written anything about Casey. So obviously some of my information comes from there, although it also comes from having read his works on thinking. And you're quite right in what you say, that he probably was a victim of a change within the whole working class intellectual movement, where both the Communist Party and the Labour Party were trying to squeeze out Deakin's ideas. And I must just say one other thing while I'm, to some extent, taking your point, which is I'm always very reluctant. When you're dealing with someone who is, to some extent, obscure and attacked by everyone else, I'm very reluctant to ever stand up and attack such a person. And therefore, I'm very pleased that somebody's come along here who happens to be in agreement with Casey and is willing to defend him. That's reasonable. For all of that, I think there's a lot of argument, and it would be very difficult to go into it at length here, to show that, to some extent, I gave one of the examples, two examples in Casey's works. I mentioned the one about the man being living and the man being dead. I mentioned the other one about closing the door. I seem to recall another one about the obituary that was written of, was it Deakin's son, which Casey wrote a letter complaining about on the grounds that it was wrong to begin an obituary by saying that Deakin's son had died. This apparently was not, this was pure formal logic and was not dialectical. No, I think that the problem about Casey, as you will probably know if you know more about him biographically than I do, is that according to many of the things that were said, he was somebody who partly misrepresented Deakin, simply because he was an extraordinarily eccentric individual. He was somebody, together with somebody else who was a great defender of Deakin, as far as I recall, the man who first translated him, W.W. Craik, who also got into a lot of trouble in that he apparently was accused of stealing some money from the labour colleges and had to go and live outside the country for some time as a result of this attack on his reputation. In the same way, Casey was, as far as all the information is concerned, somewhat overzealous in putting forward the arguments of Deakin to the point that I think he overstated and misrepresented some of them. As I mentioned earlier, the only political party I ever know of which actually sold the books of Casey was this one. It sold them, as far as I know, during the 1940s. I don't know any other period when he sold them, but I know it's the fact that it sold them then. And I think beyond that, I ought to, I probably ought not to comment any further except to say that I would be interested to hear any further arguments you have in favour of the intellectual reputation of Fred Casey.
Did you know that Tommy Jackson's book was largely directed against the attack on Casey?
Yes.
Anybody else?
I still don't actually understand how the point was. It went back to the point where they started, where the before it was the interpenetration of both boxes, and that was that wasn't a static thing. That was that grew out of formal logic. How did it? How was that sort of position actually defended? With the example that you gave of Raymond Barlow with formal logic, it just was. And with dialectical logic, it wasn't just as it was, it was a historical process. How did he get back to that original static position with the unity of process?
Well, as I say, it's actually related to another theory which is important to Marxist philosophy. The most important theory of Marxist philosophy is the theory of fetishism. And according to Marx's theory of fetishism, which didn't only apply to economics, it's a broad philosophical theory, the way in which people perceive things is very often only the perception of the appearance of things. And therefore, for example, you may perceive that commodities have intrinsic value, but in fact commodities have value based upon the amount of socially necessary labour time spent on their creation. In the same way, Stalin's argument was that there was only an appearance of difference between the two, and it all came on the basis of this major argument about the transition period. You see, look at it from the point of view of formal logic. From the point of view of formal logic, capitalism is capitalism. It cannot be anything but that. It does not contain the seeds of its own destruction. According to Deakin, capitalism contains within it the seeds of anti-capitalism, of socialism. Capitalism, therefore, contains, to put it in the form of the, what Russian dialectical philosophers called the famous triad, you would say that there is a thesis, which is capitalism, that there is an antithesis, which is that within capitalism there are the contradictions leading towards its breakdown, and there is a synthesis of that situation and the contradictions within it, which is socialism. Now, of course, Stalin could not accept that position. It was politically unacceptable, because according to Stalin, Stalin didn't only have a new view of philosophy, he had a new view of giving birth as well. Because according to Stalin, as I've said on other occasions, the pregnancy was going to come after the birth. In other words, you have socialism, and then all of the conditions giving rise to socialism are allowed to develop. That was Stalin's whole conception of socialism, that you create the new society, then you build up the means of production, then you start to break down classes, then you start to build up mass consciousness. In other words, all of the preconditions which are supposed to go on within capitalism are supposed to go on after its disappearance. So it follows from that that Stalin had to find something else. The way he found it was by the philosophical argument that there is only an appearance of a difference between socialism and capitalism. He argued that here you see socialism with its wage labour, its capital, its government, its monetary system, its wages, but this only has the appearance of being the opposite. In formal logic, it may appear to be something different. In the earlier dialectical logic, it may appear to be something different. But according to this new form of philosophical trickery, Stalin's argument was, of course, it is actually something different. Because the way in which this new system operates is apparently along the lines of capitalism, but formally along the lines of socialism. In other words, the government which exists is not a dictatorship of capital, but a people's democracy. A people's democracy is, of course, something which grows out, it was argued, of a dictatorship of capital. Here you have a working class. Stalin would argue, yes, the reason you've got a working class in Russia is because this is part of the evolutionary process. It's a dialectical appearance of being the same thing. But here you have a working class which is not the exploited class, but it is in fact the ruling class. Here you actually have, according to Stalin, an exploited class, the working class, which is the ruling class in society. It's actually administering society in order to engage in its own exploitation. So, clearly...
Trotsky used the same argument.
What?
But the working class actually engaging in its own exploitation.
Well, yes.
How can the working class exploit it?
Yeah, exactly. So, but this is only an appearance. Stalin would say, don't be deceived. I know you feel exploited. I know that according to formal logic, you are exploited. According to Deepskin's old-fashioned logic, you are exploited. But always remember that there is a unity of opposites. In other words, that what actually exists is something which is in fact opposite to and the same as. And of course, you know, this is the kind of thing which goes down pretty well if you're dealing with education classes with, you know, Moscow University academics. Ah, this is a new idea. So, something which is black is at the same time white. Now, this is philosophically very interesting. And of course, the story of the Emperor's New Clothes, you carry on saying it, and then the first person who comes along and says, but that is the same as that. Except, apparently it's the same as that, but I'm afraid you'll have to go down to grade two. You haven't quite accepted the new dialectical logic. And that is a problem. I can only advise you to read that in 1936, what was the name of that book, by Stalin, the book that was given to all Communist Party members, you must know, you studied it.
Leninism.
No, it was called The Guidebook to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
The Short Course.
And that was it. And that was in The Short Course. There's a chapter in The Short Course, apparently written by Stalin, probably not.
The Courage.
Which is called... It wasn't written by Stalin, actually. Because he opposed, in the later arguments over... Russian dialectic, Bukharin took the position that wasn't accepted by Stalin. It's in there, and that's the book I would advise you to read. I mean, I've got a copy of it here, so if you want to look at it at some point, you can, and actually study how Stalin put this forward.
As far as I can remember of Stalin, his task was to extend formal logic to the absurdity of trying to claim that capitalism and socialism were one unity and that you could have capitalism and socialism going on at the same time. That's how I sum up this evidence. Anybody else?
Is it a bit like the example you gave before then, when you could argue for the end of existence with formal logic, where a man's body is actually dying or a person's body is actually dying and living at the same time?
Yeah.
Sort of idea of unity of opposites.
You see, let me just say, in real terms, what Stalin is saying is absolutely correct. If you look at it from one point of view, if somebody says, look, the argument of the Russian government is that they haven't yet got socialism. They're building socialism. That's the current phrase. But they say, we're building socialism by creating the means whereby socialism can come about. Because one of the means whereby socialism can come about? Capitalism. It's like somebody, I was addressing a meeting once in Glasgow, and somebody shouted out from the back of the hall, if it wasn't for the Labour Party, you wouldn't be here today. And I said, you're bloody right, we wouldn't. We would have finished our job long ago. And the fact of the matter is, of course, you could argue that the Labour Party is creating the conditions whereby you establish socialism. But then, of course, by that logic, Mrs. Thatcher is arguably an even better advocate of socialism than the Labour Party is, because she is even more insistent upon intensifying the conditions by which that system no longer exists. So, in that very simple sense, you could say that the argument has something to be said for it.
Anybody else that's bogged down with this intricacy of
Bogdan.
Yeah, you could say that. You know, I think that you can overemphasize this to some extent. It wants a bit of thinking about. But the fact is that if you've got two opposites, like private property institutions and common ownership, you can't have a unity between those two, because as absolutes, they are, one excludes the other. As a system of society, you can't have capitalism and socialism existing all in the same system of society. It's a contradiction, of course, that excludes this explanation about thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And the Jewish conception of history is based upon a study of past history. And obviously, if you look, for example, at feudalism was a system which, to some extent, was static, but created within that system factors which made for its disappearance. So the fact is that feudalism, like any other system of society, like chattel slavery, existed for years and years. And all the time, and all the time?
A long time. No,
what I was going to say is that at the same time, was creating, particularly in the Roman military, slave state, was creating factors which led to its disappearance. But until that took place, the system was slave society. That's how it has to be understood. I mean, you can't, as far as we're concerned, Socialist Party of Great Britain, we are concerned with capitalism as a transitory system. I mean, it's not an idealistic conception. It's a concept which is, it is an empirical concept, which we say that capitalism will exist until you get socialism. Now, there is a period, obviously, when you can say that capitalism exists with its antithesis, but there comes a time when capitalism changes to socialism, and that is a sudden event. And I think that the concept of this penetration of opposites is what Marx and Engels were talking about. They were talking about a process which, to some extent, we might think is a deterministic process, but it's a process that's going on in society's development, which proceeds on that basis, proceeds on those lines. It's not a question of trying to suggest that capitalism can exist and socialism can exist side by side. And that's, in my view, is what Stalin was attempting to do. He was apologising for the fact that what they had in Russia was state capitalism, and he was trying to impress not only the people in Russia, but the world in general, that what was happening, of course, was socialism. Anybody else?
I suppose I commend the observation that the subject which has been discussed tonight is, in a sense, is too valuable to be left alone to just this one lecture, because I think that it's not in a sort of a new direction which has been hidden for too long. And I'd like to suggest that perhaps sometime in the new year that our lecture could give a lecture on Keynesian dialectics. Because from my reading of it, the Keynes's constant attempt was to, in a sense, make dialectics the habitual way that ordinary people did their thinking. I think that if he had been talking, you know, and trying to illustrate the unity of opposites, which we've been discussing tonight, he would have perhaps chosen an example like this actual discussion. In other words, we have unity of opposites between the lecturer and the audience. I mean, there would be
know, lecture without an audience, and there'd be no audience without a lecturer. So there is a unity of opposites there. And there's interpenetration between the lecturer trying to convince us of what exists in his mind and the audience trying to grapple with that and come to an understanding. And of course the synthesis would take place, I mean, the thesis, the antithesis and the synthesis, when we are as competent as he is to debate on this level of understanding about dialectics. And I think that Casey's entire efforts as a lecturer was to, in a sense, use dialectics in that sense, so that people in their work, in their lecturing, in their college or their science, I said, wherever they happen to be, in a sense, are so trained that they can automatically use dialectics in any situation in which they find themselves, and so come up with comprehension.
Yeah. Well, on the first point, yes, I would be at least personally agreeable to the idea of doing a talk on at some time on Casey and dialectics. And obviously that can be discussed further. No, I think actually that the example you gave, in fact, gives me the example of quite where the unity of opposites is an incorrect argument and where the interpenetration of opposites is correct. You see, you're quite right in what you say, that there is, in a sense, a unity, there's a meeting here, which can only take place as a result of there being somebody speaking and somebody listening. Any conversation or any meeting is going to involve that. But of course, and you're right in what you see as being the conclusion of that, which is some kind of synthesis. Where I think you're wrong is to describe that as a unity of opposites. Because you see, if it were a unity of opposites, then it would only be an appearance that one person was listening and another person was speaking. It would in actuality be the case that one person is speaking and another person is simply, so to speak, speaking with the ears. I would be said to be listening with the mouth. Clearly, by that kind of logic, one would be making a mistake. What we can say is that there's an interpenetration of opposites in a very subtle way. I mean, I can tell you just how the interpenetration of opposites works in a way that some people wouldn't even understand. I've given so many talks that I now know whenever I give a talk that I look around, and if I see people falling asleep, that affects the way in which I speak. Usually affects the way in which I speak, I should say. Therefore, that is an interpenetration of opposites. I'm standing here, I'm not listening to myself, but just by detecting how bored people are, I begin to speak in a more boring way. On the other hand, if I'm saying something which is interesting and people are saying, that's a good point, I attempt to amplify and extend myself into these points. Now, that is a sense in which there is an interpenetration of opposites. There is a direct relationship, an inseparable relationship between a person speaking and a person listening. But to suggest that there is a unity between that, that there is in fact only an appearance of a difference, I would say would be philosophically incorrect. You're absolutely right what you say. You find no discussion of the works of Deitzkin these days. I'm very, very pleased to say that the only work on Deitzkin in the last 10 years or so which has attempted to seriously present the ideas of Deitzkin to people interested in philosophy was written by a member of this party called Adam Buick in the journal Radical Philosophy. And that article on Joseph Deitzkin is something of a classic, I would argue, in terms of the presentation of these views. I think you're absolutely right. It would be a very good thing when you consider the nonsense which is being studied in philosophy departments in universities at the moment. One would like to think that that could be countered by serious discussion of the works of Deitzkin and other dialecticians in places like this.
On that last point, it seemed the idea you were opposing would be the idea of the... I don't know if it's ever been referred to, but it seemed that you were opposing an idea of the identity of opposites, that you were opposing the idea that the speaker and the spoken to are identical, and they're both speaking. But I would have thought that if you use the word unity, it's somewhat more acceptable of that, because you could argue that the communication itself, the object and the subject, or the speaker and the listener, between them form a unity, in that that unity is the communication or the conversation or the meeting, and that they are the constituent parts of it. In that sense, I find that provided you don't argue that there is an identity between them, they're both identical, but they do form this, they do form a one entity between them.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. I think it's going to depend a lot on what you want to do with words. I'm talking about the history of an actual concept, which is the idea of the unity of opposites, which to my knowledge has always been used in the way that you refer to the identity of opposites. If you want to devise a new theory and a new term, then, you know, you perhaps sell it to an academic journal and get £50 or something, but there's not much more you can do. I mean, it's true. There is, of course, a unity between what's going on here at the moment. But, as I say, the term unity in philosophical terms has been used in the sense of identity rather than something halfway between interpenetration and identity.
You didn't use the term identity. Stalin didn't refer to this as identity.
The term identity of opposites is sometimes used. Yeah. The term unity of opposites is sometimes used. Unfortunately, I would need a far greater grasp of Russian than I can have in order to know how the thing develops, how the concept changes in translation. And I've never seen any reference to the argument that Stalin didn't mean unity but meant identity, or the other way around.
Have we exhausted ourselves, or is there anybody else that wants to...
Just one last one. I'm surprised that Steve made no reference to the Parties publication on historical theorism, and that merits some consideration. Perhaps when you talk about Casey, you could talk about McClatchy.
Well, just to say briefly on that, and I'll choose my words carefully as well. Certainly, in the case of McClatchy, all I've read of his, he obviously made some contribution to this whole thing, if only in very clearly stating ideas which have come before him. If I were advising anyone to make a study of dialectical materialism, I would not advise them to read the chapter in the Parthian pamphlet and stop there and consider themselves knowledgeable on the subject, because I think they would be far from it by reading that. Nevertheless, I'd advise them to read that along with other things.